So I pleaded with Barry to permit me to introduce the last three speakers. And the reason it was that all three of them are personal friends. And what I want to say in introducing Ira Helfand is that he is a most remarkable doctor. He was a graduate of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He went on to work on public health and work on other topics, but is now an emergency room physician in his hometown in the Berkshires. Ira has introduced a new topic to the work of Physicians for Social Responsibility. He has worked with people who are concerned with climate change, concerned with the ways in which climate affects human nutrition, and he has published a remarkable review of the way in which a small nuclear explosion would produce an enormous famine in parts of the world, in fact, some loss of food to a large part of the world. And so it is for this reason that Ira has been honored by IPPNW and by PSR, has placed him in his leadership, and it's a privilege to introduce Ira Helfand.
Thank you, Victor. It is for me a great honor and privilege to be introduced by Vic Seidel, who was one of my professors at medical school and one of the people who helped to shape my commitment to social medicine and meeting the broader social responsibilities that we in the health professions need to experience. The two previous speakers have talked about some very compelling ongoing humanitarian disasters in the world. I want to talk to you about something which hasn't happened yet, fortunately. It makes it a little bit harder in some ways for people to, I think, focus on the importance of this issue because it is still a potential health problem that I'm talking about rather than one which is actually occurring. But because of the extraordinary dimensions of it, I think it demands our attention. Physicians for Social Responsibility and IPPNW, our global federation, have for the last 30 years sought to educate the public and the medical profession about the medical consequences of nuclear war. At one point in the 1980s, there was a fairly general understanding that a large-scale nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union would have been a disaster not just for those two countries, but for the entire planet. What is new, and what Vic was alluding to in his introduction, is the understanding, new in the last 5 or 6 years, that even a very limited nuclear war, the case that we consider is a regional war between India and Pakistan, a very limited war involving only 0.5% of the nuclear weapons in the world today, that too would be a disaster not just for the countries that fought the war, but for the entire planet. And this is a disaster which is a real and imminent threat that we need to be aware of. The scenario that we considered in South Asia produced enormous devastation in India and Pakistan. 20 million people were killed outright in our model by the explosions, by the firestorms, by the immediate radiation effects. And there was vast contamination of the subcontinent. But these effects were really only a very small part of the global impact of this war. The larger part was that caused by the climate disruption which followed from the explosions. 100 cities attacked by nuclear weapons, 100 firestorms, 5 million tons of debris lofted into the atmosphere at very high levels where they don't wash out by rain and have to take about a decade to settle back by gravity's pull. As a result of this injection of debris into the upper atmosphere, sunlight is blocked out and temperatures across the planet drop. And there's also a very significant decline in precipitation. The temperature drop averages about 1.3 degrees centigrade over the surface of the planet on this scenario. It doesn't sound like a great deal until we look at it in comparison with the global warming that has taken place in the last 130 years. and which so commands our attention. The blue line on the left-hand side of this graph shows all the warming that's taken place since 1880. And the red line on the right shows the cooling that would take place in a matter of 3 days after a limited war in South Asia. As a result of this, there would be a significant shortening of the growing season in many important food-growing areas in the world. It's a difficult slide to see, but the areas that are shown in various shades of blue are experiencing shortenings in their growing season. There's a similar effect on precipitation because the air is cooler, less water evaporates from the oceans to fall back as precipitation. And there's a very significant disruption in global precipitation patterns. Some areas get more rain, but on average, there's a significant decrease in rainfall. And the areas that are boxed in red on this map of the globe show important food-growing areas where the precipitation declines by anywhere from 40 to 50% in the first year after this war in South Asia. As a result of this, there's a very significant decline in food production. Studies that we published in 2012 looked at a number of key crops. We looked at corn here in the United States, the world's largest producer of corn, and found that production was down an average of about 10 to 12% for a full decade. It's uneven over time. In the worst year, 5 years after the war in South Asia, the corn crop is down by 20%. We looked also at the production of rice in China, the world's largest producer of rice, and found a similar pattern. There, the decline is about 15% averaged over 10 years. It's worse in the first few years where production is down by as much as 20%. We also found in China there was a very significant variation geographically. Some provinces, the ones that are shown in light green in southern and eastern China, actually had a slight increase in food production, in rice production. But all the provinces shown in shades of tan and brown experienced significant declines in rice production. And, for example, in Heilongjiang province in the northeastern part of China, which is home to 35 million people, the rice crop fails completely in the first year after this limited war, not in China, but in South Asia. And production remains 60 to 70% below baseline for almost a decade. Based on this decline in food production, we issued a report last year at the Nobel Peace Laureate Summit in Chicago. And what we looked at was, you know, what happens to human health if there's this kind of food shortfall? We're not in a good position right now to withstand this kind of a shock to our food supply. World grain reserves amount to anywhere from 65 to 75 days of consumption, depending on whose estimates you use. This is a very small and inadequate buffer and would not in any significant way mitigate the effects of this decline in production. In addition, there are today in the world about 870 million people who are malnourished at baseline. They get less than 1,800 calories a day, which is the sort of standard figure for an average-sized adult to maintain his or her body mass and do a little bit of work to gather food or to grow food. So 870 million people. There are, in addition, 300 million people in the world today who get pretty good nutrition but live in countries where much of the food is imported. And in the aftermath of this nuclear war in South Asia, with these large declines in food production, international trade in food would probably come to a complete halt. Grain exporting countries in particular would suspend their exports to feed their own people. And so an additional 300 million people living in Northern Africa, in the Middle East, in Japan, in Korea, in Taiwan, places that get good nutrition today, would also be at risk of inadequate food supplies and possible starvation. We concluded, based on this in our report, that up to 1 billion people worldwide could starve to death as a result of this limited war in South Asia. Since then, there have been some additional studies done, which we will be publishing in a new report to be released in mid-December. I can share the data with you today. And the bottom line is that the new studies are much worse than the studies on which we based the estimate of 1 billion people dead. What we were able to do this year was to look at other crops in China. And we found that the rice production is actually a bit worse than we found in our first look at this. We estimated then it would be a 15% reduction over 10 years. It now looks like it's a 17% reduction. Most importantly, though, the bottom line on this slide is the effect on wheat production. Wheat in China is the second largest food grain for human consumption, just a little bit smaller in total output than rice production. And the wheat production in China is going to be down 39% in the first 5 years and an average of 31% over a full decade. This data really implies that we need to look fundamentally again at what we came up with last year. The figure of 1 billion people dead assumed that there would be no famine in China. With this kind of decrease in food production, we now need to understand that there's a very real possibility there will be widespread hunger in China as well, putting another 1.3 billion people at risk. And even if the majority of these people do not actually die of starvation, it is going to cause unbelievable economic and social chaos in China. The largest country in the world, the second largest economy, the most dynamic economy in the world, and a country with a large nuclear arsenal of its own. That's the bad news. The good news, and there is some, and I'm going to stop showing you slides because I'm about to run out of time. The good news is that in response to this data, there is a growing international movement calling for the abolition of nuclear weapons. Most recently at the UN, just last month, 125 countries signed a statement calling for the abolition of nuclear weapons. This is up from 15 countries that signed a similar statement a year ago. And there's been an enormous movement fueled by a new understanding of the humanitarian consequences that will result from even a very limited use of nuclear weapons. The one area where we're not making a lot of progress is among the major nuclear powers, and especially here in the United States, where this message is not widely known. And the appeal that I would issue to you is to help us get this message out. There is an urgent need for leadership in this country to take this into account. I've had conversations at the State Department. The people who are making decisions about U.S. nuclear policy do not know what is going to happen if these weapons are actually used, and that needs to change. There is a responsibility incumbent upon us as health professionals to address this issue. It's been recognized for decades that physicians and other health professionals have a responsibility to speak to this question. We have to understand that if we do, we can affect policy, and if we remain silent, we confirm the impression that many people have that the nuclear danger has gone away. I hope this presentation has made clear to you that it has not. A war between India and Pakistan is a very real possibility. They've gone to war 3 times in the last 50 years, have come close 2 more times in the last 20 years, and there's been fighting between India and Pakistan essentially every day this year on the truce line in Kashmir. So this is a real danger. And there's also the danger that the larger arsenals of the other nuclear powers would be brought into play as well. And that's another topic which I don't have time to address for you today. So thanks very much for listening to me, and thanks for any help that you can provide ongoing in getting out this important message. There's a short 2-page summary of the report on the table in the back of the room, and I have copies of the full report available if anybody wants them. A new version will be coming out in about a month. Thank you.
One fact I neglected to mention at the start was that Ira has recently been elected one of the co-presidents of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. If there's anyone in the audience who is not aware of IPPNW, you should remember that the first two co-presidents of IPPNW were Bernard Laun and Evgeny Chazov, who accepted the Nobel Prize on behalf of IPPNW. So it's a privilege to hear from Ira, who is the immediate successor of these people. Let me have time for 1 or 2 questions, please.
One of the things that I think we have not paid a great deal of attention to, and has not become very popular information even among ourselves, has to do with the real consequences of Chernobyl and the fact that the Chernobyl event released something on the order of 50,000 times more isotopes into the atmosphere of the northern part of the world than all other uses and abuses of nuclear power. And contrary to the International Agency, International Atomic Energy Commission, and their statement that there were only 4,500 deaths associated with Chernobyl, which is a popular, quoted figure, the 20-year anniversary report from the New York Academy of Sciences put that number at 940,000 deaths. Fukushima is at least 4 times as bad. And I think that if we integrate some of that information in our thinking, it may help to move this question and this position forward.
for those of you that couldn't hear, it was a comment to the effect that we need to take into account also the terrible consequences of Chernobyl and Fukushima and the enormous amounts of radioactivity released by these two nuclear accidents. Were there any other questions? Okay.
Well, we're on the right.
Please. The question was, could the cooling effects of this limited nuclear war offset the effects of global warming? No, actually it doesn't. It makes the situation much worse. The cooling lasts for a decade, but at the end of that decade, there's a vastly larger amount of carbon in the atmosphere from all the fires that have taken place, and the heating picks up again and goes ahead at a more accelerated rate. So I think there is a real question whether human beings will survive on this planet. And there are two huge threats to that survival, nuclear war and climate change, and we really need to address both of them. Thanks.